Good evening, it's Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, and this is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is the 6th of April, 2024. That makes it a Saturday evening. This is going to be chapter number 13 in Mosaic 3, Inflammasomes, where we're going to integrate our discussion of metaphysics and epistemology with the final association to ontological arguments and the biochemistry of the inflammasome. So now we're going to do the synthesis of the two major topics that we're completing this mosaic with. Hopefully it's something that's both enjoyable and educational to you. Let me know. You can always email me at authenticbiochemistry at gmail.com. So look forward to hearing from you anytime. All right, so let's get off where we were here. I was getting to the point where I was saying, at a metaphysical level, the ordering of time in sequence might play the regulatory role in biochemical phenomena, suggesting, of course, temporal signatures involving changes in molar concentrations of those molecular components. That is, if we propose that time is a phenomena-based, ever-occurring series of relative quanta, then biological systems appear to be trapped in a causally closed temporal universe. But I want to remind you, we should not confuse correlation of temporal sequence with causation. So, time is argued to be without sequential bias, with past, present, and future all being equally ontic states. But this precise premise needs to be examined, because when we do, it is not the nature of time we measure of past, present, and future, but don't we always measure our present state, that is, current time? And many people, I think, make the mistake, and you see, I've already explained why, that is a state of being. I say it's still, even though it's present, and therefore, for the immediate purposes of examining it, fixed, it is still within the sequence of events temporal that are becoming. Now, reason, again, we're talking about this is I want you to think about the living system like this. Living system is constantly adapting from conception to death. You know, the human being, the human body. So everything we talk about in biochemistry, in fact, all the disease states are initiated, progress, and then either resolve or cause morbidity. And that's when typically surgery or behavioral modification or pharmacotherapeutic introduction invade into the process. And my argument has always been, I mean, ever since I started teaching biochemistry for either medical school or in a discussion of the human biochemical systems, that any introduction of any therapeutic, and I just named three of them, a behavioral lifestyle, a surgical, which is much more medical, and of course, pharmacotherapeutic, which also involves, of course, a medical intervention, is entering late into a process. Late because the process has already presented itself. That's why the physician and the patient knows there is some kind of disease state. So that means whatever may have been occurring in the immune response, for example, that genomic response will have already been tailored to examine and surveil the stress assent to the appropriate immune response to correct it by using epigenetic rewriting of gene expression, and on the road to getting to a successful resolution when there is an introduction of any of the therapies I just talked about. Okay? So, time is argued to be without the sequential bias, as I said, because there's all these equally ontic states, but present is really what we always talk about. And doesn't that entire calculus I just went through for the last couple of minutes involve some kind of acceptance of a biochemical future that is still yet to be realized? So it pushes the present into the future. So there's an externalist argument you've probably heard, and that's in favor of determinism. And also that means biological, biochemical determinism. And I argue that that ignores that the future itself is unreliable, uncertain, and that it requires a perpetual corresponding input from the activity of the agency involved in the response. So, again, just getting metaphorical and also more metaphysical, history tells us that the past is fixed. Present relies upon it, however, for all of this sequential ontogeny. So the future must then be dependent upon a present, that a present biochemical state, for example, that must follow from its predecessor for any of that argument to even be valid. Yet, from all experience, don't we reliably record that the future is only probabilistic? Although I argue that's only to narrow down decision-making, because the future is actually possibilistic. So some might argue that these are minor nuances, and minor nuances can bring about unpredictable consequences. Now that has a name, that's called the chaos theory. But chaos, nice Greek word, right, still argues for some kind of determinism by holding on to some kind of mystical power of vortex, going back to Anaximander maybe, that circuitously but somehow absolutely ends with B coming from A, you know, A to B, right? That there is neither proof of that assumption nor any argument that I can think of that holds promise to obtain its validity via logical dialectic, I think negates the chaos theory as an amusing thought experiment at best, you know, using a whole lot of imagination and not a lot of understanding, if you know what I mean. Okay? In my opinion, and when I say opinion, I actually mean opinion here and not a dialectical analysis followed by synthesis. So here is just a mere opinion, because these kinds of things can only really be at the level of opinion, although that's even arguable. But I say chaos theory, for any kind of use in a scientific perspective, is pure fantasy. So the presence of time as the measure of becoming in the world, in the cellular world, for example, is absolutely unmistakable, as it is the state from which we project both ourselves and any cellular system or biochemical pathway into the future of as yet undetermined outcome. So to argue that the entire system turns toward an inevitable outcome from a very large overall homeostatic environment to the abundantly very small movement of a carbon-based quark requires that time has to be treated as a solid dimension, which we normally prescribe for space. But we know because of the general theory of relativity that space is not a solid dimension. That is a fabrication. Space only exists where there is time. And time only exists as a sequence of events realized a priori by the functioning of the mind. Because time itself, although a form that we treat as a form, has no existence without human thought. If you remove all human thought, there is no time. Now, one could argue, well, there's still time for all other living things, but all the other living things then are still necessarily, if they are programmed according to time, such as tree growth, according to their phenomenological sensoria, such as photosynthetic and respiratory conditions and water uptake and nutrient uptake, including anionic and cationic nutrients from the soil, the photosynthesis process itself, C3C4, or CAM photosynthesis, photorespiration being involved in some of those systems, and then the lignification process, the production of the cell wall, you know, pectin, cellulose, hemicellulose, all that. It's all part of the developmental process of the plant. So whatever is the plant responds to, certainly not a sensoria like our five senses, but however the plant's responding, it's a response to its environment. And even though there's temporal signatures all through those living systems, for sure, just look at the rings in a tree when you cut down the tree. I cut down a lot of trees. So I do look at how old the tree is after I cut it down. But that, again, is me measuring the time. And measuring the time, how we understand the tree rings are developed in an annual programmable sequela, which is still all part of how the living organism responds to the environment and how we respond to that numerical sequence. Okay, see what I'm saying? All right, so I don't want to go too much more through this whole thing about spending more time on time itself, but I will say this. Okay, and now that we're into it, why not? Eternal time in a relativity theory driven world, which I just was trying to elaborate on, special relativity notwithstanding, more general relativity is where I was getting my ideas from. The relativity theory driven world is something obtainable by means of transport, albeit ultimately at the speed of light. Never mind that the composition of matter, for example, the matter that is found in human or anything living on Earth, has no capacity to travel at that speed, nor has it been theoretically or assuredly experimentally predicted as a lived experience. So neither pure reason nor empirical inquiry will get us to this relativistic, and there's the, I'm using that word now in the pejorative, which Einstein didn't like, and I can see why, the relativistic state, yet we are to believe this theory as it indeed were on faith. Now, the difference between this leap of science-based faith and that practice in, say, traditional religion is fundamentally different. Religious faith does not require proof. Scientific theories require physical evidence if they are to survive even mere skepticism. Nevertheless, we are asked to accept the proposition that gravity explains the bending of light by matter. Clearly, this can be measured, but what is missing is the research isolating gravity as an event in itself. Ever since I can remember, I found myself asking questions like, as soon as I learned gravity was how we describe what mass is involved and why things fall to the earth, right? My first reading of, say, Galileo's experiments, I was pretty young when I first read those. Elementary school for sure. A question I might have been asking is, how does gravity explain those interactions of matter? Now, we call such interactions gravity because we put that explanation into the physical world. So essentially, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. There is nothing inherent in atoms that can be isolated as a pure event that explains why gravity obtains. One of the flaws of this gravitational attraction repulsion force that I've reasoned anyway is the absence of time in those equations. Now, if time were to somehow invade the gravitational inverse relationship, going back to Newton, it would need to be differentially equated. Again, back to Newton. To some maxima and minima, where time was the scalar. Now, in such a hypothetical, I might also mention that Leibniz also came up with the calculus, so I don't want to give credit only to Newton, because Leibniz definitely also came up with it. In fact, some say before Newton. Anyways, in such a hypothetical, it seems to me that there would eventually become a time when you're doing differential equations, when gravity ceases to function. So imagine that, since we're using our imagination, not our faculty of understanding very much here. Now, again, this isn't my field. This is from subatomic particle physics to astronomical physics. None of that is my field. I'm just a bystander, just like you are. Now, all this brings me back to inflammasomes, of which I do feel comfortable discussing. Recall the significant contribution of the acidic sphingomyelinase mediated ceramide regulating membrane raft associated inflammasome activation that involved uptake of cholesterol. Yes, you remember that. Hope. It was only a couple of days ago. We did that in lecture. Now, reduction or absence of acidic sphingomyelinase, I'm just going to call it ASM from now on. Reduction or absence of ASM activity has been shown in the literature to lead to a deposition of sphingomyelin and a whole host of well-characterized lysosomal storage diseases. So classic ones that are talked about in clinical biochemistry courses, like one would be Niemann-Pick diseases types A and B. So ASM catalyzes the breakdown of lipoprotein sphingomyelin association, even at a pH well above the acidic, 7.4. Now, the difference in pH when the lipoprotein sphingomyelin is a substrate, now sphingomyelin in the membrane, reflects the fact that ASM transcriptome See, now this is the underlying complexity that you don't think about or hear about unless you listen to authentic biochemistry. That the ASM transcriptome generates two distinct forms of the protein. There's a secretory ASM called SASM. And then there is the extracellular lysosomal ASM, simply called LASM. Okay. We biochemists aren't as clever as the geneticists giving cute little names. We just basically try to give names describing what they're doing, right? S for secretion, L for lysosomal. Right? Pretty straightforward over there and inside our heads. Now, the two forms of ASM arise from alternative trafficking and also post-translational modification. And that protein then gets re-trafficked. Okay, so all of this trafficking of ASM to the lysosome is required for clustering of lipid rafts in endothelial cells and then all the function imparted therein. Now, multiple stimuli are known to regulate ASM activity, such as direct oxidation, bacterial and viral infection, as well as fungal, irradiation, different movement of ions, particularly potassium we talked about, protease activity, lipase activity, and the production of reactive oxygen, wherein activation and extracellular secretion of ASM can be induced by directly hydrogen peroxide production. So ASM activation triggered ceramide-enriched domains can be simply abolished by gene silencing of the GP91 FOX, that's PHOX, which of course is a subunit of the NADPH oxidase. Now that's all about this ceramide-enriched domain, right? Now, ASM activation can also be achieved through dimerization of the protein. And that occurs because of a direct oxidation of a carboxy-terminal cysteine residue in the monomer ASM. Now, what does that demonstrate? Demonstrates that the reactive oxygen can be used for ASM performing its ultimate function. See? Now, all of that's lost, because these are all details, when we simply say that acidic sphingomyelinase is involved in making ceramide rafts, which controls way downstream the inflammasome activation. Right? All right. So here, time must be considered. Because it takes time to carry out those activities, right? Yes. So time is the foundation for what has passed, but it's equally the template for what is to come. And those are connected by the moment presently occupied. Same thing in metaphysics as in biochemistry. So the turnover of sphingomyelin to the membrane raft ceramide, which, remember, is required for appropriate inflammasome immune responses, must follow a spatiotemporal pattern, which we've recently described in a lecture. So recall that the inception of the NLRP3 inflammasome activation, the NLRP3 protein complex performs as a sensor polypeptide. What is it doing? It's recognizing endogenous and exogenous danger signals, which recruits the accumulation of the adaptor protein ASC. I once again will give you the full name of that. That's the adaptor molecule apoptosis-associated spec-like protein containing ACARD. Okay. That's what the ASC is, and the effector protein procaspase 1, all of which have to form this pro-inflammatory, pre-proteolytic complex, right? Which we've been talking about. Remember, procaspase 1 is activated to form active caspase 1, and that leads to the production of mature interleukin 1 beta and mature interleukin 18 by cleavage of their precursor polypeptide, right? Now, under excessive activational control, endothelial dysfunction and consequent vascular injury and inflammation may obtain. This is what we've been talking about with the inflammasome being part of disease presentation. Now, this is the aspect of the pathophysiological endothelial NLRP3 inflammasome after pro-antherogenic stimuli, one of which included cholesterol crystal, but also ATP, uric acid, and the hyperhomocysteinemia and damage-associated molecular reorganization of the glomerular process in the kidney, for example. Okay. Now, all of us previously addressed, and again I will address it, NLRP3 inflammasome activation correlates with increased ionic potassium flux, enhanced production of reactive oxygen, and that lysosomal rupture. All of those components I just told you about are prolegomena to atherosclerosis during the pathophysiological response to hyperlipidemia, and then the subsequent progression of renal glomerular sclerosis during hyperhomocysteinemia, right? Yes. So remember of this too, because I'm adding everything back while I'm doing your synthesis. The endothelial FASL protein, as well as tumor necrosis factor alpha, oxyLDL, a protein called visfatin, and a protein called endostatin are all found to induce the formation of that membrane RAFT cluster coming from ceramide-producing acid sphingomyelinase, translocated to that location for membrane RAFT generation, in which the NADPH oxidase subunits, such as GP91 and P47, are aggregated to amplify that NOX activity in the arterial epithelial cells. So, ASM-mediated membrane RAFT redox signaling platforms ultimately executed an essential role in the endothelial NLRP3 inflammasome. And each of those nested translocations and primings and activations required appropriate time to follow through this sequence, and any interruption in that flow, that temporal flow, would compromise the steady state kinetics of the protective role, which is ultimately being played by the inflammasome. So when the metabolic past was future, there was regulatory opportunity to shape the pathophysiological sequelae that obtains in the present state. This is the fluid molecular dynamic followed by a genetic kinetic recombined by the immunoepigenome. Let me check my time. Oh, perfect. This is Dr. Dan Guerra on a Saturday evening saying bye for now.